Hey folks, I'm taking this episode to advertise for other podcasts. If you enjoy stories about the people behind the technology that we use, you should check out the Greater Than Code podcast. They focus on the human side of software development with stories of diversity and inclusion, accessibility from people that you don't normally hear from. Search for Greater Than Code in your favorite podcast app or check out greaterthancode.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Dr. Corey Fraser. He's an engineering manager at Intel Corporation, and you worked on the space shuttle. You have got the most amazing LinkedIn. I am just enjoying reading your LinkedIn, and that is not something I can say about everybody.
Oh, well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me on.
No, it's absolutely my pleasure. It must be pretty exciting to get to work on kind of two of the main technological improvements of the 20th and now the 21st century, the space shuttle and then semiconductors.
Yeah, most definitely. I can't lie. I pretty much won the lottery in that regard and working on some of the most complex technical challenges that humankind is working on. You know, I think the space shuttle itself was called one of the most complex, engineering efforts at the time. Then now you have semiconductors with the lower complexity it gets to as you get smaller and smaller. And then supercomputers themselves are entire systems that have complexity, approaching, but not quite that level, but, getting closer to things like aerospace or medical or stuff like that. So, yeah, it's really, really cool. Mm-hmm.
So your undergrad is in aerospace engineering, mm-hmm. and then your master's was in mechanical engineering with a specialization on thermal and fluid sciences. And then you got a PhD in mechanical engineering. Is mechanical engineering, it's a pretty big, wide open field. Do you have a specialization within mechanical engineering?
Yeah, I would say my specialization from like a master's level was, more of the shock waves, looking at heat transfer, particularly heat transfer in these shock to test apparatuses at long test times, which we use to characterize chemical reactions over a certain period of time to see what derivative chemical reactions are. And then as I got to my doctorate, my specialization was on the combustion side of solid rocket propellants, specifically the modeling of them with nanocatalytic additives.
Mm-hmm. So I've got your thesis open here, and I read it to the best of my community college degree. And one of the things that struck me is that you're exploring how ammonium perchlorate behaves. And is the goal here to make it burn hotter and faster and increase the rate that it burns so that it has more explosiveness and then takes the space shuttle up faster?
Yeah. For the space shuttle program, they have their special blend, which it's fairly standard with ammonium perchlorate and iron oxides and, a little bit of aluminum to help taint it. And then their fuel. In the case of what we were studying in that research is used a lot for things like maybe missile research, where you have certain rockets or, some sort of propelled body with a solid propellant. And you're trying to get to perform in certain regimes where maybe it has a very high burn rate, like really fast, like you were saying, but get, maybe to a target faster or something of that nature. Or sometimes you may want to see what the effect of a nano additive could be, some metal oxide to maybe make it burn longer over a longer period of time or maybe slower. And then there's other regimes that get very interesting, like Mesa burning, where maybe it'll burn really fast and hot and then kind of flatten out in this burn rate and then maybe decrease. Or an intermittent situation where it burns hot and fast and then suddenly it kind of stops for a second because of maybe some of the way the geometry is changing or some of the way the fluid properties are working on the propellant as it's actually burning. And so it kind of stops for a second and then starts again. Mm-hmm. So these are all different things that, the military uses for, whatever application they may be using it for, which I would not know, but they find it interesting.
Indeed. Well, I think we've all, you know, been at a cookout or at a campfire, and we've burned wood and then sprayed it with something we shouldn't have sprayed it with, like an accelerant to go and, you know, make the barbecue go faster. But mostly that just kind of makes the fire go flump. And then we go, wow, that was interesting. But you're describing not just how things burn, but how they burn over time with, and I assume the goal is to be able to have control, right? You don't want to just light something on fire and then just hope for the best.
Exactly. You pretty much nailed it in a much simpler explanation than I was providing earlier. It's they're looking for a way to control the burn rate, because the thing about a solid propellant versus a liquid one, like you were just describing, you know, on a fire and you squirt, you know, gasoline or something on it, you know, that's control. You throttle that by, you know, how much you're squeezing and pressing or whatever the case may be, right? Much like the space shuttle's external tank with the liquid propellant that comes through. But a solid propellant, once you light that, it's pretty much going. You know, you can't really stop it until it pretty much burns out. And so the idea is, how do we control the burn rate of a solid propellant in a rocket, but at the same time have do so with just whatever the propellant itself is, or the properties or the design and shape of the motor itself, without having to actually introduce any other mechanisms to try to, you know, funky motor designs or something like that to control the burning rate, or some unique device.
Mm-hmm. Is solid propellant in a rocket solid because we want it to be very dense and have more, like, you know, the amount of space that it occupies versus the amount of potential power that it represents? Or why is it solid? Why isn't it just liquid?
Yeah. Well, there's multiple reasons. There's what you can pack into it, the density, like you were saying. But there's also shelf life. So when you have a solid propellant, in fact, a good example is your airbags in your car, right? How it deploys quickly and fast, you know, when an accident happens and the little igniter you know, goes off, that causes the propellant to burn very fast, and then fill up the airbag with all the expunged gases. That ability to store that propellant somewhere on the shelf for, you know, years at a time, and then have it still work, is part of the benefit.
Oh my goodness. How do people practice this though? If you've got something that's burning at, I don't know, 1400 Kelvin, how do you experiment with this, and how are the people who did the experiments not all dead?
This is a great question. Very carefully. It's amazing. Even as a college student, you're going through, you know, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms training, you know, about how to handle this stuff, right?
Really?
Yeah. In fact, there's, you know, sidebar, whenever you get a chance, maybe Google the Pepco disaster. But Pepco was a place, it was a chemical plant that had ammonium perchlorate stored within its various, you know, storage areas. And it didn't do a good job of keeping it clean. And so there was, like, you know, particulate dust of ammonium perchlorate around. Plus, they had lots of canisters and containers underneath a lot of pressure and ammonia perchlorate.
That was in 1998. And the thing that was interesting about it was that it was one of only two places in America that would produce ammonium perchlorate.
Right.
And you'd think that if they're making it, they would know how not to break it. And in fact, two people died, and it cost almost $200 million in property damage. Horrible, horrible thing.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. You recall way more about it than I did.
I try to do my research when I have PhDs on the show.
Yeah. And it was just amazing, because I won't say they forgot. I'm sure they didn't forget this, but, you know, there was probably a degree of, I don't know, vigilance and safety that maybe just wasn't followed. But, you know, ammonium perchlorate, it's really its own fuel and oxidizer. And under high enough pressures, it experiences, you know, enough temperature such that it could start to undergo, you know, this gasification that will lead to a combustion event. And so, going back to, you know, us now as students, you know, we have the ammonium perchlorate. We actually had to wear, like, lab coats and EMI, electromagnetic discharge, static discharge. I can't remember. It's not EMI. It's another acronym that's escaped me right now. Mm-hmm. But we had to wear special shoes, which were made by Converse, I believe, if I recall. So that was actually kind of cool. We got to wear Converse sneakers that were for like being in the lab.
Wow.
We had to wear these special shoes to make sure we didn't have any electrical discharge that would happen and possibly, you know, make the ammonium perchlorate go off. We actually had the lab when it was constructed, and this is at Texas A&M at the Turbo Machinery Lab, just to give them a bit of a shout. We actually had to construct the lab, and we had to build in steel, you know, rebar, and we actually had a test cell. So that all the diagnostic, you know, work that happened on the computer, taking in the data from the rise in pressure and temperature when we had the propellant within a what we call a strand bomb, all of that was behind these reinforced walls, such that if something did happen, it wouldn't endanger us.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, so it was pretty nuts, and it was funny. We actually had shock tube testing going on next door where we were doing other chemical kinetics experiments. So it was like, huh, you know, there was a lot of reinforcement going on. But it's a lot of safety protocols, a lot of making sure that you're not carrying things forward and back and that you have no static charge on your body. In some ways, you know, often we probably viewed it as overkill a little bit, but you know, the smallest thing could happen, and when that happens, you know, then you look back on it and, you know, say, okay, take every precaution we need to.
Yeah. Safety first. Those shoes are ESD shoes, electrostatic dissipative shoes. Yeah. Those are no joke. It's not just your regular old shoes. You got to make sure that they have to let that electricity go into the ground, right? You're basically grounding yourself.
Yep, exactly. In fact, you know, you had a little tag and you stick the tag. Actually, Intel is kind of the same thing for the folks who go and, you know, and test the different, the quality of the silicon and everything and run it through its validation.
Now, you made a comment a few paragraphs ago where you said that this ammonium perchlorate is its own, it's a fuel and an oxidizer, but then your PhD thesis talks about these additives, these nano additives. So I know nano means small.
Yeah.
What kind of small things are we adding that's going to make it better than it already is?
Yeah. So at the time, I'm not sure where the research is now, but at the time we were adding metal oxides. So things like ceria, or titania or titanium oxide.
Like tiny pieces of metal?
Exactly. Yeah. And bonded with oxygen. And basically, you know, these tiny pieces of metal, the smaller you can get, it creates more of a reaction site because you've increased the surface area upon which different chemical reactions can occur. So that's the idea of using these metal oxides. The metal piece, and this is probably going a little bit super in depth into a level of chemistry that I don't have, but you know, the metals probably have some sort of electron, you know, level behavior that helps stimulate chemical reactions more effectively when, especially when combined with the oxygen. But the size of these particles are what enable them to be effective because one, you're able to get more into the chemical composition of the solid propellant, but then you've got so many of them around, it winds up creating more reaction sites. Just like almost, because like I was saying before, you increased your surface area. So now you've got more space available upon which to actually have a chemical reaction, which helps stimulate the burn rate, the combustion reaction of the propellant.
Hey friends, you know how I love great podcasts, and I want you to check out the Code Newbie podcast. It's all about stories from folks on their coding journey. They talk to new developers, experienced developers, and everyone in between about how they got started learning to code, how they navigate their technical careers, and they also do deep dives into technical topics in a newbie-friendly way. Check out their podcast at codenewbie.org/podcast. That's codenewbie.org/podcast. So you bring up a really interesting question. So for those of us that are like regular people, we kind of mythologize PhDs. Like it's such an amazing thing that you have such a deep specialization in a thing. But that you just, for example, said, well, that goes farther into chemistry than your PhD goes. That's kind of cool. Like, I just assume y'all know everything. But you're saying that there's a specialization. Do you then work side by side with like with a chemistry PhD, and then they reach their limit, and then they find a material sciences PhD, and then you all work together?
That's pretty much it. In fact, when I was doing my research, there was a material scientist over at University of Central Florida that we were working with, and you know, and he was able to look at what we call the agglomeration, and basically that's when you're creating these nanoparticles. Mm-hmm. You know, like anything in nature, whether it's, you know, I don't know, rocks in space, they're trying to come together to form planets or something mm-hmm. else. When you're trying to make something super small, it'll want to have a desire to come together with other things, right? And make it a little bit bigger. But you don't want that, because the larger size you get, the less reaction sites you have. So with his material science background, he was able to put these nanoparticles through the various processes to actually make them small enough so they wouldn't agglomerate or come back together. Mm-hmm. And so it was his expertise and his know-how as a chemist and wherever the machines and the processes that he was using to actually create these particles at as fine a size as we were looking for.
Mm-hmm. So let me shift the conversation, because you and I met when we were volunteering to teach young people science, technology, and math. And I'm looking here in your PhD, and I'm looking at some of your energy equations. And I'm teaching my 11-year-old algebra now, and he's getting into quadratic equations and stuff like that. And I'm trying to understand, how do we take an 11-year-old or a 13-year-old or 15-year-old and in just 10 years turn them into a PhD candidate? Mm. How does that happen? How do we make more Corey Frasers? Yeah. And how do we scale that? I mean, were you doing advanced math when you were 10 and you had a jump start? Or was it sponsorship and mentorship? What took you that far?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, I think you touched on something that I think is really important for me to say, that hopefully we'll demystify maybe the whole being a PhD thing. And that's that I actually don't like math that much.
Oh my God, this interview is over. Right. It's done. I'm hitting stop.
I'm a heretic. You know, but you know, honestly, you know, beyond algebra, I'm not really a fan of math. But yet you have to take one at each new graduate degree level. You have to make it through that class, and I will be honest, I made it through those classes by the skin of my teeth. But the thing is, I think that shows that, you know, being a PhD is there is no cut formula. There is no template, no expectation that every PhD has all of these skill sets that you would expect. So not every PhD is great at math or enjoys it. Not every PhD enjoys, chemical equations and balancing those equations, right? But the PhD the nomenclature of it and the idea behind it is that you understand enough of the principles that you can go and better understand something through investigation, through research, through deeper diving. So you can teach yourself or come up with those scientific understandings by virtue of employing whatever the methods and principles are that you learned. And so to the point that you were making about, getting your son started on math, and certainly I had no far more advanced level of math than anybody else. But the idea is to get kids interested, you got to get them started early. That doesn't mean that later isn't a good thing to do. But the earlier you get a child to see themselves doing math, doing science, and in interacting with people who they know, you know, can do this or look like them or who sound like them or who have the same interests, the more likely, you know, they are to pursue these careers, and the more likely that they're going to be resilient against obstacles in these careers. Because some of the biggest challenges are for kids isn't that they don't like math and science, and so they don't go into it. It's that they start to see things as a challenge from the standpoint of, okay, these problems were hard, in this class in science or in math. I don't want to deal with that. Or I feel embarrassed that these other kids over here were able to understand, you know, this problem and I wasn't. So I need to now retreat from that. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, maybe it doesn't seem as cool anymore. Maybe there's a societal pressure for them to back away from being smart. I think it's a little bit less apparent nowadays because nerds kind of rule the world a little bit more than they used to. You know, when you and
the nerds will inherit the earth, right?
Right. You know, but I think the more you tie in their ability to do these things and seeing other people. Mm. Who maybe they identify with or maybe they even admire who are able to go down this path, it's even better.
Yeah, and to your credit, one of the things that is a characteristic that you're known for, and I'm going to use one of your LinkedIn recommendations as an example, is conscientiousness, meticulousness, and thoughtfulness. You don't necessarily have to be an expert at everything
right. If
you have attention to detail. Mm-hmm. My son... or my theoretical daughter doesn't have to love math, but they have to respect it, know that it's a tool,
exactly. And
double check their work is what the current thing the 11-year-old is working on right now. It's like, you don't have to love it, but if you double check it, it's a tool and it's a very powerful tool.
And to be honest, that meticulousness and that approach, I think will not only benefit your son, but benefits anybody. And I say this all the time about, you know, STEM or STEAM, is that even if you don't go into a traditional science or technology or mathematics-based field and you pursue something mm-hmm. that's more on the art side, having technical knowledge will help you in your art. Having an understanding of, you know, being detail-oriented, double-checking, understanding, mm-hmm. seeing things through a method, through an algorithm, you know, in your head will make it far easier for you to take those things and execute those steps in your art. Honestly, it helps me a lot, not even just with engineering or something technical or super technical, mm-hmm. but spreadsheets. When I'm working on spreadsheets and I'm doing something that's a high pressure situation for some executive or trying to crunch mm-hmm. out some document or some kind, often my mm-hmm. ability to double check something or see the algorithm for how it needs to be executed saves me time or makes me look really good in front of that executive person because I'm able to execute to some kind of method, you know?
Mm-hmm. The thing that I want them to understand also is that there's so much power in this. Like you were talking about blowing things up, but what you're actually talking about is theorizing that things will work a certain kind of way, then testing it and proving that you do in fact have an understanding. Like these models, these equations, for lack of a better word, they've been proven to be factual because we observed that they are in fact what they say they are. Like you are predicting the future with math and then proving it by doing actual experiments.
Exactly. To be honest, that's the thing that interested me, the most about working with models and simulations and why I was so keen to do this project work when my advisor approached me about it is because at the end of the day, prediction is about helping people see around corners. And when I started to reframe everything, because I was helping my lab mates see around the corners of what tests, what chemical compositions should we execute or should we go and develop and then, you know, test our theories on. So that way we save time, we save energy, we save resources. Mm-hmm. And I take that same application to engineers at Intel, where we do thermal and structural analysis for, you know, supercomputing hardware. And I tell them that, hey, the reason we're doing this prediction is not for the sake of data and just feeling gee whiz about, you know, getting temperature and all these, you know, numbers coming up all over the place. It's so we can help people make decisions more effectively earlier to save cost and bring about a better experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I suppose if you got the model wrong, you could waste a year building a whole real thing and say, oh, we were off by an order of magnitude. We missed a zero there. You know, you got to tear it all down, start over.
That is entirely possible. hopefully when you have a model, you can put it through enough tests or put it through the paces just enough so that you can catch, you know, a mathematical error or, you know, some other semantic issue, you know, that won't affect the end product, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were working while you were getting your doctorate. So you were basically commuting. Were you working at night and doing your doctorate in the day? Or how many hours did you – did you have extra hours we didn't know about?
The answer is yes to both. But yeah, I was actually working full-time in the space program and then driving 2 hours one way from Southeast Houston and all the way up to College Station to go to Texas A&M and making that commute anywhere from 1 to 3 times a week for about 3 years. And yeah, it was a very interesting experience. But what I did was I basically you hit it on the head. Sometimes I was working during the day and then I would go to school in the day and then somewhat at night. And then sometimes I would wind up working at night or on the weekends. Fortunately, my job was very charitable and they were willing to support me. I mean, the team I had at my job was willing to support me and I would pick up the slack for them when it came to work and things like that. So I was working both day and night.
Oh my goodness. I was working 9 to 5 and going to school 6 to 10.
Oh,
although
wow.
it took me 11 years to finish my undergraduate. So I can relate. I can't relate to the 2 hour commute. My commute was only 45 minutes, but what are you doing in that? You listening to books on tape? What are you doing? Cause that's wasted time if you're not filling your brain up.
Exactly. I would say those 3 years were the years where I really fell in love with audiobooks. Mm. You know, that's all I did was listen to audiobooks and NPR for 2 hours.
Yeah. I drive up to Microsoft from Portland. It's 4 hours up and about 7 hours down and audiobooks and NPR and the occasional conference call are definitely the way to do it. Mm-hmm. So now I met you at iUrban Teen while we were both giving talks on getting kids excited about STEM. Other than telling your story, how do you shake these children and say, look at what you can do if you just stick your mind to it, if you just keep the faith and do that commute? How do you get kids to see that this is possible?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I'm always telling kids is like, man, you guys live in, obviously there are challenges in society, but you live in like the most amazing time ever. Like anything you want to do is at your fingertips.
They're living in the future.
Yeah. You know, you guys almost don't have to have imagination anymore because you can just make it seem like it's actually there, whatever it is, you know, whether it's really good CGI or it's augmented reality or virtual or something else, you know, you could pretty much say, I want to do this or I want to see it. And it can happen. And I think one of the things that's really exciting for a kid is just using the fact that there's so much accessibility. So if kids have ideas for like apps or businesses or whatever the case may be, get them started on it. You know, go ahead and say, hey, here you go. And a lot of this stuff, you know, or a lot of opportunities to do these things are pretty low bar. I won't say free necessarily, but the bar is pretty low to be able to access a lot of these things.
Yeah, just the existence of Khan Academy has been extraordinary for my kids.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
like how did we learn math before? I guess we had paper and we had a TI-89 calculator was basically all we had.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it's like, man, I wish I had so many more of these things as a kid because I would have certainly been able to have applied what the teacher was telling me, you know, much more readily and then be able to find my passions, get jump started a lot quicker rather than existing in my own head until I got to college for the most part, you know, as far as what I wanted to do. And so I think for the most part that kids need to be able to put their hands, you know, literally or figuratively on the thing that we're talking about when it comes to STEM. So at iUrban Teen, you know, we're doing at these summits, we're doing, you know, these different tests are like in the healthcare arena, you know, if we're talking about preventative healthcare, we're talking about how we're using data analysis or AI or something to help us do better healthcare. We have actual healthcare professionals running a workshop that's showing them how this is being used, right? And I think kids need to actually see that. If it's something regarding technology and everybody likes sneakers and a sneakerhead, I'm trying to become one. I'm not one, but I'm trying. But if they see how, you know, what does Nike do? I believe, Matthew Nurse was up there talking about what Nike's doing with technology when he gave his talk. But if they could see how technology is playing a role in the very things that they like, you know, then that's what, you know, gives them that sense of, okay, yeah, this is great. This is a, something I should pursue, because there's other things to do when it comes to Nike other than being an athlete. There's plenty of things on the technology side. There's other things I can do in sports.
Right.
In fact, sports is very much so dominated by data and technology right now, whether it's statisticians or it's actual, you know, human performance data, right? So it's, give them the opportunity to see things.
I'm hearing applied. Like, it's like theoretical science is not going to light a 9-year-old up or 11-year-old. But if you tell them, like Matthew Norse, the example you gave, he's the director of the Nike Sport Research Lab. This is somebody who's taking math and science and applying it to making shoes, to making, and then ultimately making athletes successful. So you got to draw a straight line between that equation that my 11-year-old is working on and then someone's success.
Exactly. Application. We live in a world where, you know, at this point, you know, everybody has this immediate gratification sense. So if you're getting someone that immediate contact, an immediate touch point, it's sticking a lot more readily. Mm.
Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you chatting with me today, Dr. Corey Fraser, and I appreciate you going out there and fostering a culture of innovation at Intel and the work you did in the space shuttle.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Scott. I really appreciate you having me on, and this has been fun. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you, sir. I hopefully see you again. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.